Hello, I'm Ben Ryland, and today on the Monocle Arts Review, we're gearing up for the weekend and looking ahead at what's on at the movies with The Telegraph's film critic Tim Robey. We'll be mulling over dark drama Indignation, the crime thriller Dog Eat Dog, and of course J.K. Rowling's latest magical escapade, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Now, our first film today, Indignation, it's an adaptation of Philip Roth's 2008 novel of the same name. Fill us in on the plot. What's going on here?
So this is about a young Jewish freshman in 1955 from Newark, New Jersey, which is where most of Philip Roth's characters come from. And he goes to, enrolls in Winesburg, Ohio, which is a very WASPy, very Christian establishment college. And he kind of has to play the game of hiding his Jewishness to some degree, or at least not making a big deal out of it, in order to kind of, you know, get along. And there's a Jewish society there, but there's also a lot of veiled anti-Semitism, which really comes to the fore, particularly when he has a big argument with the college dean, played by Tracy Letts, and just the kind of polite face of 1950s American prejudice is what this film is really about. And it's rather good. I mean, Philip Roth has been very badly treated on film, it has to be said, up to this point, and I think this is one of the better ones. I still think I'm slightly in two minds about it. There are certain aspects of it that work better than others.
I'll ask you more about that in just a moment, but first, here is a clip.
What worries me
is Olivia Hutton's mental history, especially in light of the circumstances.
Why did you come and stand under my window?
Because it just makes me feel like I'm making sure you're okay.
She is weak. A person so unstable is a menace to you, Marky.
I'm afraid something terrible happened. I'm afraid I may have had something to do with it.
Interesting to hear that Tracy Letts is in this film. He's probably better known as a writer, of course, the playwright of August Osage County. What's he like making making an appearance on the big screen?
Yeah, he's done a little bit of acting before in film and quite a lot on stage, actually. He's one of those guys who does a lot.
I was very lucky to see him in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf some years ago, actually. He is quite good on stage.
Yeah, and he popped up in The Big Short, actually had a role in that. He's really great, and he really has one centerpiece scene in the film. I should have mentioned that the female character is this fellow student called Olivia Hutton, who's the classic Philip Roth kind of chic-sir, pretty blonde character who the main guy falls for. But she turns out to be quite damaged, and they have their kind of relationship becomes rather fraught. But yeah, Tracy Letts' scene, I think, is the real standout moment. It's a nearly 20-minute long scene, and it builds very softly, and it's a very kind of polite exchange of views at first, which becomes increasingly prickly as the Max character, Logan Lerman's hero, really starts to kind of bridle against the sort of subtle demeaning language that the dean is using towards him.
So Logan Lerman has also been praised for his performance in the film. He's a standout too.
I think he's good. I think he was better still in a film called Perks of Being a Wallflower, where he played this very sweetly confused kid at school. And in this, it's almost as if the same performance is kind of trying to work again. And it doesn't work quite so well, because this character is meant to be a lot more bookish. He's kind of more... there's more of a kind of repressed anger to him and a kind of intellectual... kind of fury that I don't think quite comes out often enough, except in this one big centerpiece scene. I mean, Philip Roth is so difficult to adapt because the kind of internal elements of his books, the kind of sense of a kind of character monologue, are incredibly difficult to present on screen. So what we get here is the external facade, if you like, of 1950s prejudice at this kind of very elite college, and this poor kid trying to fit in, and this poor girl who's kind of got her own family problems, and the two of them become quite a combustible mix. But what we don't entirely get is enough of their point of view, if you like. Mm. There's something a little bit too polite about the filmmaking.
I suppose it can be difficult when you're adapting something like that to translate what a lot of those internal monologues into an external expression of something that gets that across to the audience without having the characters launch into these big monologues, sort of like I know some of Woody Allen's serious films get attacked for that. The characters say what they're feeling without just being able to just feel it.
That's right. And I think that's where James Seamus struggles with this adaptation. It's his first film as a director, but he's obviously been a very established producer and screenwriter who's worked with Ang Lee many times. And I think there's something overly genteel about his approach. it's very diligent, and he kind of he gets a lot of the ideas that are in there, but he does, he presents them in a slightly almost too sort of too organized a way. I wanted the film to be a little bit looser, and a little bit take a few more risks. That said, though, I do think it's pretty good, and by the standards of Philip Roth adaptations, it holds up much better than most.
Well, Indignation is out today in the United Kingdom and available in cinemas around the world as well. Now, our second film, Dog Eat Dog, is a slight change of pace as we enter the violent world of three ex-convicts trying to adapt to civilian life, but they're not going to settle in quietly. Our three protagonists, Troy, Diesel, and Mad Dog, are picked up by a mob and paid to kidnap a baby from a rival group. Let's hear a little bit of a clip of this one.
This is the game plan. Big job for us, baby napping.
Well, that don't sound so good.
It's not, and I'm not saying it is.
There's a gig, and there's a lot of money at the end. Run away to Hawaii. It never works out.
I think it does sometimes. You just don't know about it, because they run off to Hawaii, and you don't ever hear from them again.
So, Tim, run us through the plot of what is happening here.
Yeah, so these three guys are ex-cons who met each other in prison. Nicolas Cage, Willem Dafoe, and an actor called Christopher Matthews, something rather, he's a virtual unknown actually, who I didn't recognise. And the three of them are corralled into, or kind of persuaded into, this harebrained scheme to kidnap a baby and extort the father for ransom in the middle of the film. That gives you the idea that it's a sort of heist movie gone wrong scenario, which is sort of roughly what you would get, I think, if you read the novel, which is by Eddie Bunker, the kind of famous jailbird writer who turned up in Reservoir Dogs, for instance. But this isn't quite what we get in the film, it has to be said, because it really is a big mess. The kind of set, there's that kernel of the plot is almost by the by, and there's a lot of scenes of them just hanging out in strip clubs in the kind of grottiest bits of suburban Cleveland, and it's kind of trying to convey this kind of sordid sense of a slice of life more often than it is charging into a real genre plot, I think.
A bit of an odd mix of genre here as well, because it feels as though when you're watching the trailer that it's being sold as a bit of a comedy. There are a lot of wisecracks. There's that music that we just heard there that maybe suggests a bit of a fun comic ride. But then it's also being sold as a bit of a thriller and a crime movie. Where does it sit on the scale between those things?
I think the answer is very uneasily. It's a real hodgepodge. And it's Paul Schrader's kind of throwing lots of ideas at the wall here. His recent output as a director has been, to be honest, pretty dismaying. And the last few films have been close to unreleasable, really. And here it feels like he's trying to prove that he can still make a film with some energy. And what he most often reminds you of is like 90s Tarantino. He's going for that sort of grisly black comedy where, you know, the kind of sight of someone being stabbed to death is sort of darkly hilarious. I don't think the tone works, though. I think it actually comes across as really quite unpleasant. And the kind of stylistic excesses of the film, which begins with this kind of very pink-hued drug sequence with Willem Dafoe going crazy in his girlfriend's flat, and then there's a black and white sequence in the strip joint, and it really all kind of fits together very oddly. It's very haphazard.
Interesting you mentioned Tarantino there, because of course Paul Schrader is known for many classic films, one of them being Taxi Driver, which no doubt influenced a lot of Tarantino's work. What do you think? What are your thoughts when we get to a point in a filmmaker like Paul Schrader's career, like where we are now, where it feels as though perhaps he's still relying on some of the tricks that he pulled earlier on in his career, but pulling them off to some sort of lesser success?
I think it's pretty disappointing to see, because I think his film career as a director is so interesting. Post Taxi Driver, he made, you know, Hardcore, Blue Collar, Light Sleeper, fantastic part for Willem Dafoe, Affliction, great part for Nick Nolte, many great films up until the late 90s, and then it really tails off. I think you can sense his struggle to kind of keep producing interesting work within the studio system, and it really bottomed out with his film that he made with Lindsay Lohan called The Canyons, which practically ended his career. And this feels like an attempt at him sort of rehabilitating himself by saying, I can still do the kind of young, punky energy sort of filmmaking. Look, I've still got it. Unfortunately, he's made a film that feels like it belongs in the 90s. It feels 20 years out of date. And it's doing a lot of the kind of tricks that Oliver Stone was trying when he adapted Tarantino's script for Natural Born Killers. It's doing throwing all these different kind of badly fitting, not really meshing together stylistic elements into a big, great pot and not really cooking them up properly.
I completely forgot about that film, The Canyons. I did I had the displeasure of watching that. You're
it
right.
It was appalling.
It was one of the quite unusually bad as well, though. Not just a bad movie, but bad to the point where you just think, how did anyone make this?
It's startlingly bad. I mean, the really depressing thing about Dog Eat Dog is that it's not Paul Schrader's worst film, because it kind of should be. The Canyons is even worse. I mean, The Canyons is absolutely beyond the pale.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? That's Dog Eat Dog out in the UK and the US. And finally, we couldn't end today's show without talking about the film event of the week, the much-anticipated Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which sounds a little bit like this.
Something is stalking our city, wreaking destruction, and then disappearing without a trace. Witches live among us.
We've lived in the shadows for too long. I ask all of you, who does this protect? Us or them?
Danger. He senses danger.
So, Tim, a friend of mine was trying to tell me about this film earlier in the week and erroneously referred to it as Fabulous Animals and How to Spot Them. but convoluted titles aside, this film is really being sold as something for fans of Harry Potter, isn't it? How are those fans? They tend to be quite a demanding bunch.
I mean, that is a very difficult question for me to answer, in fact, because I'm not a big Harry Potter fan. I found this pretty engaging. I think it does clever things to bring in even the more kind of casual non-convert to the Harry Potter universe into this parallel universe, which has kind of similar rules. Whether the Harry Potter loyalists, as it were, will consider it actually not quite what they want is a very difficult question to answer. I mean, I think one of the really good decisions in the film is that it's, even though the main characters, again, are wizards, magicians, and so on, there is one of them who's not. There's the character played by Dan Fogler, who's called Kowalski, and he is a muggle, or in the American parlance, he is a nomad. He has no magical powers. He's just an ordinary guy off the street who gets swept into the kind of story. And I thought that was a really good move for J.K. Rowling to choose someone, a muggle character, and make him such an important figure. He's very likable. He gives a really good comic performance. And he pulled me in because I'm slightly on the outside of the whole thing myself.
It was interesting. I saw a clip of J.K. Rowling talking about this, and she was talking about when she had the idea and she put it to the studio, and they were all on board and everyone was very excited. And she asked the question, well, who are we going to get to write it? And they said, oh, no, you can do that. This is the first time that she's actually written a screenplay, which is astonishing, really, when we consider how far the whole Harry Potter world has come.
That's right. Yeah, she didn't do the original adaptations herself. And she's done a pretty good job with this one, I think. It is a good script. It sets out its world very neatly. And I think she's got, you know, in David Yates, who directed more of the Harry Potter films than any other director, a resolutely safe pair of hands, who's never going to do anything desperately surprising, to be honest, but kind of handles it all fairly well. I liked the recreation of 1920s New York with a kind of magical spin on it. And I thought it was good to have it set in a slightly more real time and place than Hogwarts, because we don't really know when that's meant to be. So that was another way to differentiate itself quite neatly from the original Harry Potter universe. I really enjoyed the film for quite a long time. I think the kind of mischief of it is really engaging. It started to lose me slightly when it became a bit more kind of epic in its kind of ambitions, in fact, because then it becomes more formulaic. There are a lot of big effects showdowns towards the end where we're dealing with a clash of kind of ideology between the radical dark wizards who want to kind of rule the world, essentially, and the ones who want to assimilate into Muggle society, which felt to me a little bit too similar to something like the X-Men films. It felt a little bit secondhand, to be honest, and I preferred the film when it was more idiosyncratic and just chasing these beasts around New York, and that, I think, is pretty good fun.
One idiosyncrasy about the Harry Potter films, not that I want to continue comparing this film, but it is being sold as part of the Harry Potter world, but those films feel very British, even though they take place in these other worlds quite often where it may not resemble anything that we really know. You still feel as though you're in some version of what is very, very British in the movies. This one takes us out of the UK and takes us to all different kinds of places. As you say, another version of New York. Do you still get that feeling of that very playful, fun, lighthearted Britishness? I mean, we have Eddie Redmayne leading the cast.
He's really the one kind of element of continuum from the original films. You can imagine him in the Harry Potter films, and his character is mentioned in the books, I think. But other than that, she has again decided, J.K. Rowling, no, we're going to do something different this time, and we're going to see how this plays out in a more kind of sceptical, hard-bitten environment, specifically Prohibition America. And I think it works quite well. I think the novelty of that is engaging. I think the danger of keeping the British kind of setting for it would have just been for it to be too hermetic, essentially, and stuck in the original, you know, mode that those films were in. So it has rung some changes, and I think it's done so pretty well.
Well, certainly better than perhaps tuning into another Harry Potter film for, what, the 27th time or something. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is showing in cinemas absolutely everywhere. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks to my guest, Tim Roby. You have been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday. We'll be discussing this year's Paris Photo with Kathleen Fox Davies. And don't forget to tune into the cinema show tonight at 20:00, where we'll have the writer-director of Bleed for This, Ben Younger. He'll be telling me all about how he went from a successful career in politics all the way over to filmmaking. Quite a change indeed. But for now, thanks for listening, and bye-bye.